Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better. Remember to let it. Then you can start to make it better.
Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the first visit by the Beatles to the United States of America. This Saturday marks the first visit by former Beatle Paul McCartney to this region. A musician, musicologist, professor, and chair of Skidmore's music department, Gordon Thompson has been studying British popular music in general, and the Beatles in particular, for almost 20 years. His book, Please Please Me, 60s British Pop Inside Out, brought a fresh take on a well-known subject through interviews with artists and repertoire managers, music directors, recording engineers, songwriters, and session musicians active in London in that decade. He has lectured on the rise of Beatlemania and the role of New York in the Beatles' American success, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Gordon Thompson to the Roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Joe. Nice to be here.
Very nice to have you back. So we're talking this morning, and of course, we're getting ready for the Paul McCartney visit to this region on Saturday. And I guess for any town, really, but especially because when you look at the tour cities, Albany sort of seems to be the, you know, it's major cities and then us, which is very cool that ultimately saying is quite a coup that we got him, I guess.
Yeah, I think so, too. But I also think Paul McCartney is taking an interesting strategy here with places like Albany. He's adding on these cities. I think this is taking a page out of Bob Dylan's playbook, which is Bob Dylan's been, for the last decade or so, been going not only to big cities, but to smaller cities, too, as a way to build on fan base. Because at this point, Paul McCartney doesn't need to tour financially.
Right.
It's nice in the money coming in, but he's doing this basically for his legacy, to help build how people remember him and build that fan base still.
It seems in the most recent concerts that he does that exactly what you're talking about, that legacy building, where it's much about the Beatles. There are some other eras that are talked about, like the 70s that we spoke about a few moments ago on the show. But it does seem that he is looking, mining the nostalgia vein, if you will.
He is. I really have a sense. I think McCartney has always had a sense of that Beatles phenomenon, that he is one of the keepers of that legacy. Because even back in the 70s in his shows, he would include Beatles tunes on those. It was always like he was cultivating and curating that legacy and that repertoire. And that's when folks go to, if the folks who are going to the Albany show, if they've not been to a Paul McCartney show, this is a man who loves to perform. He loves an audience. You will get in there and there will, at various points in that performance, you're going to have the sense that he's talking to you or that he's paying attention to your part of the audience. He has this amazing ability in a concert, and you've gone to one of his concerts. You have this sense that you're there in the room with him, and that he somehow acknowledges that you're there. At least you're collectively. It's not like somebody who's coming out and just kind of like running through their routine. They've got it all rehearsed. You can see that they're acting and putting on a show. Paul McCartney really gives you a sense that he is there. And that is part of, I think, of this sense that he knows what his legacy is, what he represents. And now in a concert, when he comes out and performs, he knows that audience is there in part to relive that experience and be part of that legacy. And that's an amazing thing that he knows that he has that value and that ability to do that. And that is part of his responsibility.
And when you think about it, it seems like few others could do that, in the sense of, I remember when I saw him about a year ago in Brooklyn, what fascinated me was obviously his performance, but also how people reacted to the music, of how incredibly emotional that got for people. So whether it was Yesterday or Blackbird, whatever,
yeah,
of how people become so emotional, by the music and so invested in it. And I just can't imagine too many other people having that sense.
Well, music already for us has this really interesting psychological phenomenon of linking us to particular places and times in our memory. It has this way of drawing us to a particular point in our lives. You hear a song and you say, oh yeah, I remember I was in college or I had just gotten married or something like that. A song has that way of kind of like connecting you to a particular point on the space-time continuum, right? And nobody has more music. Think about the longevity of this man's career. From 1963, if you're in Britain with Love Me Do, up to 2014, you know, right. He has this way of just kind of like making that continuity so that he's had hit songs in every decade. I mean, it's just an amazing career. And when you go to these concerts, you know that he's going to just connect with you. I saw him in Detroit. And I was just telling you before the show that, in Detroit, they'd gone to the Motown Museum, gone through the studios. They came on that night. They did some Motown tunes just to connect with that audience. This is a man that loves an audience, and he loves his audiences.
It seems as though he understands the history of it, too. So, as you mentioned, of Detroit, but in seeing him in Brooklyn, you know, he would say, this is, when we came to New York, this was something that we played, or this is a song we've never played in New York before, or this is something we've never done here before. And even ending the tour, as I mentioned before, in Candlestick Park, that there's an understanding of that history.
Yeah. Understanding of that history, but also great prep for his audiences.
Yes.
He knows that he goes into a performance that there's an audience there with a particular mindset. I was talking with Larry Kane, who was a disc jockey, toured with the Beatles as a reporter, and he said that if McCartney had not become a star musician, he would have been a marketing executive, because he knows exactly what people want. He does the research to figure out what they want and how to get it across to them, and the Brooklyn show and the Detroit show are examples of that. I'm really interested to see what he's going to do when he gets to Albany. How is he going to, because I think he tailors each show to, there's something about the city he's playing. Sure, this is going to be, I've never played Albany before, and that'll be one of the tags, but he'll do something to kind of contextualize it and try to make that Albany audience feel like, hey, you're part of this legacy too.
And do you think, because you lecture on this widely, about New York, about just the impact that New York had on the success of the Beatles?
Well, yeah. I mean, New York was where they arrived. It's, if they had not arrived, I mean, the whole strategic planning of arriving in New York, that was in 1964, that was the core of American media. You had Walter Cronkite, the evening TV shows, the Ed Sullivan show, and the radio stations. I mean, that whole targeting of New York as a place to start their career in the United States. Yes, it was certainly determined in part by the fact that that was one of the only transcontinental jet air routes coming into the United States. We think of jet air travel as being an ancient thing, but it only started about 3 or 4 years before the Beatles arrived in the U.S., that transatlantic jet transportation. So they were going to arrive in New York anyways, but because they hit New York, tapped into that media, that was part of the reason they exploded so fast, as they just hit the main line right into the United States.
We were talking to, I guess I was talking to Greg Hames of the Times Union and Nippertown, and he was writing about the Ringo Starr show and talked about, you know, half of the British invasion that's coming to this region. Of this incredible group, we have two members who are still with us, and both are touring, both are out there, and both going very separate ways as far as the path that their career has taken them.
I'm not sure Paul really can share the stage that well. I mean, I think he's a great performer. I mean, and he's got a great.
He doesn't really have to.
He doesn't have to share the stage. Ringo, I mean, I think Ringo is Ringo. He's got his own thing that he's going to do. He gets great musicians to travel with him, too. Neither one of them, I think, wants to just move on and be themselves and be, you know, have their own part of their own part of that legacy. Ringo puts on a great show, too. And he's got great musicians who have their own little, you know, their own sections on that show. But Paul McCartney will be out there for 2.5 hours, however long that show is, he's going to be there all the time. You know, the band will get up and leave when he'll do Yesterday or whatever, or Blackbird. He will be on stage performing throughout that entire time. This is a man who was born 1942, right? He's now 74 years old. He just had his 74th birthday. He's still going. He still got it. He still got this energy. Now, maybe the vocal chops aren't quite what they were when he was 18 or 20, but doesn't matter. It's still, you still recognize that voice, and he still has this energy and excitement and an engagement with an audience and a performance.
When he became ill and there was the virus that took him out of several shows in Japan and mm-hmm. Canceled some U.S. dates as well, and there was some question as to whether the Albany show would happen, and they announced that it will, of course. But I thought the news coverage of that was fascinating and shows his importance, because it became almost international news that Paul McCartney was canceling shows,
right?
Because it's a big deal.
We didn't see Joe Donahue has a cold,
right? Exactly.
It's not on the Huffington Post.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or like Eminem, even. I mean, you know what I mean. I mean, it's not a big, you know, maybe for that city, sure, but for the entire world.
Yeah, well, I have to go through this a lot, but you know, the Beatles came along at a particular point in time for a particular generation. This huge generation, the baby boom generation, that post-war generation, comes along at precisely a moment where they're establishing themselves as adults and with their own identities. And the Beatles come along at a particular point in time, really when they were still in the age of broadcasting, when you've got three television networks, and every, you know, a city will have a couple of dozen radio stations. You know, that situation obviously no longer exists, but it meant when they came into it, everybody listened to them. There was no way of escaping them. They were just part of the American fabric and American culture. So now when they go to do shows, there is a built-in audience there that goes to see them partly to relive that experience.
When you think of the catalog of that music, it seems unrivaled. It seems that no one would ever be able to put together what they put together in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah. Yeah, and certainly the Beatles created stuff. But let's not forget that Paul McCartney has a longer career as a post-Beatle,
right,
to the Beatles. And there's an incredible number of songs in there, great songs. In fact, I would argue that one of Paul McCartney's best songs is a song that happens after the Beatles, right at the end. And that's Maybe I'm Amazed.
Maybe I'm a man, maybe I'm a lonely man who's in the middle of something that he doesn't really understand. Maybe I'm a man, and maybe you're the only woman who could ever help me. Maybe won't you help me to understand?
Ooh. It's a great song.
It is great.
And then, you know, you think about other songs he does. You know, Let Me Roll It, you know, or, you know, Band on the Run is still it's a great song. People will make fun of it. Some folks, you know, some musicians will kind of make fun of that song. But it's a great song. It's successful. It, you know, it just grabs you. So there's a long repertoire that he's developed post-Beatles. This is a man who has just a real desire to make music. And has been blessed with the idea, with the possibility of being able to do that and have an audience for now, man, 50 or more years. How many of us are going to be able to say that, right?
So he put a new album out a few months back called New, but he's not really touring for that. I mean, you're not going to find many of those tracks when we go to the show. There'll be some, but not a lot. And the albums come out, and it's still great music, but we tend to go back to the stuff we know.
Well, yeah, we tend to go back to the stuff we know. I think, well, that's true of a lot of things.
Sure.
We go to the material we know. But I think one of the interesting things about Paul McCartney is that he really has so many musical ideas. I mean, sure, you can say that, well, that's kind of derivative. He's kind of done that in a previous album, but he's always spinning off something new. An incredibly fertile imagination. You just have to really kind of be amazed at how well he's able to continue generating musical ideas and doesn't give up. He's always trying new things. Kisses on the Bottom, I think, is a terrible album. But I got to, you know, say, hey, man, you got guts to do that. I mean, to go back and try to grab this kind of stuff, that repertoire, and try to go in that direction. He's always, or the Fireman, folks don't often think he has this other identity as the Fireman, which is some great music. It's really edgy, it's got, you know, some really strong emotions, and it's not the kind of it doesn't say Paul McCartney on it. And you listen to those recordings, and you say, "Man, that sounds really, you know, that guy is really angry." There's the post-divorce album, and right. He's really angry, and you can hear this. Then you realize, "Oh, that's Paul McCartney." He can really deliver that. And he, you know, from that standpoint, I mean, in the days of the Beatles, you turn to Paul McCartney and you see somebody, this is a guy who is the musical director of this band. Sir George Martin is the producer. He's going to arrange things and things like that. But you hear those outtakes of recordings and you hear Paul McCartney and they're counting them off every time. It's Paul McCartney saying, one, two. Getting ready, getting that band, choosing the tempo, trying to get him going. One of my favorite little bits, which they released on the first anthology album, is you hear him counting them into I Want to Hold Your Hand.
Ringo, keep your bit dead.
Ringo!
We're taping. First one, very initial attack. One, two, ten. No, the first one, a loud attack. The second one, not quite so loud. Just try it. Oh, well, do it anyway. We'll just blast that bit, that one bit.
And what he's doing as they're doing that is he's getting them to shape that opening chord sequence. And you hear them going, da-da-dum, and he says, no, stop. It's not da-da-da, it's da-da-dum, you know, trying to get them to shape and phrase that opening so that the last beat is where the accent is, not the penultimate beat. So that, you know, he's really thinking about that musical quality, the musical performance. You hear him also pushing the band to get a better performance. You read, you know, both Lennon and Harrison complaining about McCartney saying, okay, take another take, another take, another take. You know, he just keeps driving this band, really frustrating them, I think, at times, but always trying to push them to get the best possible performance. And I think that's something he still carries with him in these performances. He's always looking for a great performance. And with the band he's got now, man, that's a great band. The drummer, I love that drummer. This man is so solid. It could be him and McCartney. They could probably carry the show.
And to be amongst those musicians who get to play with this guy every night, and I was thinking of this when I saw Ringo the other night too, you don't even need a check at that point,
right.
Do you? I mean, that's just...
Yeah, you talk to musicians who have had a chance to play with either of these or John Lennon, and they say, yeah, at a certain point you show up to play the thing, and then you realize, geez, that's John Lennon, or that's Paul
right.
McCartney. I'm on stage with, you know, with one of these people. Well, I'm on stage with a legend. It is kind of sobering. But I think one of the beauties of all of these folks is that at a certain point they were able to make the musicians feel comfortable. I was talking with a guy named Herbie Flowers who recorded with George Harrison, and he'd said, well, you know, you go in there and you're saying, my God, this is George Harrison I'm going to recording with. But Harrison would get in there and he'd make you feel comfortable. You know, all of these, they're musicians, they're human beings. We often forget that. You know, I tell students this when we have classes where you're reading about the Beatles or you're reading about whoever, you know, some big name. But at a certain level, you have to realize this was just a human being. You know, Paul McCartney is just a human being with all the foibles, with all the failings, all the pluses, all of those natural characteristics that we all have as human beings. The fact that we start to think of them as legends kind of like amplifies that and tilts it up to a point where we forget these are human beings. You know, and Paul McCartney gets sick, he gets a virus or whatever. It's we all do.
Right. It must be interesting, though. I mean, there's the one aspect of going through it, because no one had hit that height before. No one had ever hit that realm of stardom. So they're going through that and seeing what that's like. And then the transformation, as we were talking in the previous segment, of okay, the 70s, a tough time, and then slowly starting to come to terms with this legacy, and also the fact that the two of your bandmates are gone.
Yeah, and that's got to be tough, you know, when you work with someone like that and you lose them, and they become, and especially, you know, there's some evidence that in the days coming up to when John Lennon was assassinated, that there was talk amongst these guys about getting together to do a show. I was just doing this. I was reviewing materials for the video anthology series, which in the fall I'm doing with a seminar. We're actually going to go through episode by episode and compare it with biographies to see how that works. But in going through that material, you realize that this is a band that they still got together and talked. Even when, you know, one of the interesting things, even when McCartney and Lennon were trading legal briefs on who was suing whom, I think they still sent Christmas cards. You know, so, you know, you have to remember that, again, that these are people who have a legacy, but, you know, they obviously realize that they're just part of something that had happened. The Beatles weren't the first, just to go back to the beginning of your question, the Beatles weren't absolutely necessarily the first. There had been, you know, Frank Sinatra. And then there had been Elvis, right. And indeed the Beatles, you know, Elvis, the king, you know, had established that. But the Beatles, in many ways, showed a lot of folks in the music business how not to do it. Their publishing arrangement, which seemed, you know, incredibly futuristic at the time, this idea of a band having and songwriters in the band having their own publishing company, Northern Songs. The deal they struck and the way they tried to work around taxes and things like that. Again, all the kinds of things we as normal human beings have to deal with. They're trying to deal with that stuff too. And then, but other folks are realizing, oh, they made a mistake there. We can improve upon that. They set up Apple Records and the Apple Corps to do their own productions. They make lots of mistakes. But, you know, a lot of folks learned from, well, the Beatles tried it this way and it failed. But the interesting thing about the Beatles is they were right there at the beginning of when this stuff was happening. And they're establishing various kinds. They're experimenting. We often think about them as the musical realm of what they did. But there's a whole other side to them, the legal, if you will, the copyright, the publishing, the idea of musicians moving on to become producers. You know, because one of the things that happened in 1970 when they broke up was that they all wanted to go off and become producers on their own. They'd already started doing that in 1969. But they wanted to kind of, they were growing up. They wanted to move out and do other things while still quite cognizant of who they had been. 1980, when John Lennon is interviewed for Playboy magazine, the interviewers, David Sheff, for example, is saying, you know, well, you probably don't want to talk about the Beatles repertoire. And he says, what do you mean I don't want to talk about the Beatles repertoire? I'm really proud of the Beatles repertoire. I'm not a Beatle anymore. I don't want to pretend that I'm a Beatle anymore, but I'm really proud of what we did. So there's all of that to this band.
So Saturday night, Paul McCartney will be before thousands, was it 14,000, 13, whatever, 13,500, at the Times Union Center. And for the people lucky enough to get a ticket and rich enough to get a ticket, it's an amazing event.
Yeah. If you're going to the show, you are guaranteed of a great experience. He's going to play tunes you know, probably some tunes you don't know. The band is great. I just go back and say Abe, the drummer, is just such a fantastic musician. Not just a drummer, but also a great singer, too. He will put on a show.
Well, it all happens Saturday night at the Times Union Center. Gordon Thompson is chair of Skidmore's music department and author of the book Please Please Me, 60s British Pop Inside Out. Gordon Thompson, always a pleasure. Thank you very much for being with us. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.